Hello and welcome to Dialect. I'm Tony Gosling. Dialect is Bristol's first podcast, set up with a grant from the Scarman Trust in 2002 and has been broadcast on community radio stations in Preston, Swindon and St Albans, as well as Bristol Community FM. And we'll be back on there mid-March 2016, Tuesdays at noon on bcfmradio.com online or 93.2 FM. This week, Graham Farmelow, author of Churchill's Bomb. Also, 9/11 Truth, and Lawrence Morton is a photographer in Mid Wales that's been looking into it very deeply for several years. Dialect's produced by volunteers. We're online at dialectradio.co.uk. If you want to join in, contact the People's Republic of Stokes Croft. You're just off Jamaica Street. Call them on 0117 909 6897 or visit them on the web at prsc.org.uk. And I'll repeat those contact details at the end of the show. And we start this week with Graham Farmelow, who's the author of Churchill's Bomb. Hi, Graham, and welcome to Dialect.
It's good to be with you, Tony.
Graham, tell me a bit about yourself, because this is a fascinating topic, and many people don't realise that Churchill was even connected with British atomic weapons.
Yeah, that's right. Churchill is traditionally seen as somebody who had really quite a lack of interest in science, really, certainly basic science. But in fact, as I found when researching Churchill's Bomb, he was actually very interested in the applications of basic science to the military, and had a huge role in the development of the British bomb.
Yes, and I mean, I can remember, gosh, it must be the 1980s, reading a book by R.V. Jones called Most Secret War, which at the time was a bestseller. And I think it's probably fair to say that Churchill was rather involved during the war in keeping a very close eye on Nazi technology, for example.
That is definitely true, yes. He was assisted by his friend, Frederick Lindemann, later Lord Charwell, and he was his scientific advisor, so to speak. Yeah, you're absolutely right. Churchill did realise that he had to know about, and that's what, one of the things that made him, in my opinion, a great prime minister. He really did understand the need to be on top of science. Now, he wasn't a scientist himself, but he had the wisdom to bring in somebody who knew what he was talking about. Lindemann was an Oxford professor, a friend of Einstein, a big player in his heyday. So it spoke well of Churchill in many ways that he had that close assistance.
What brought you to this subject, Graham?
Well, two things, really. First of all, I'm very interested in modern scientists. I wrote a book on Paul Dirac, the great theoretical physicist, the British Einstein, as he's sometimes called. And when I was writing that book called The Strangest Man, I started to understand that even people like Dirac, who are very interested in very deep, basic questions about the inside of the atom, etc., even they were taken away during the war by the British bomb project. And I just wondered what Churchill's role was in it. And from that small little thread, I pulled at it, and I found out, to my total astonishment, that Churchill, for example, was, of all the writers on science in the early 20th century, was the one who wrote most about the bomb, even before it was made. So I was astonished by this. That, to me, is the most remarkable part of the story.
Now, most of us know about the Manhattan Project, the US developing the first atomic bomb.
Yep.
And some of us know that the Nazis in Germany were also working on atomic weapons during the Second World War. Some would say they had a bit of a head start as well. But not that during the war, the British were really even thinking about this. So did you discover that we were?
Oh, very much so. I mean, there were for a good 18 months or so, the British bomb project was with the benefit of a God's eye view, so to speak, was the leading bomb project in the world. Right, we were way ahead of the United States for a good 18 months, but there were various reasons, which I could go into, of course, if you want. But for various reasons, the British system ran out of steam. And we weren't able to build that bomb, of course. And I say in my book, Churchill's Bomb, that I don't think it was particularly well handled by Churchill, although forgivably so, because he was, of course, under a huge amount of pressure. And in the end, the Americans just walked away and Britain was left having missed the bus, so to speak, and just playing a really relatively small role.
Well, I'm very surprised that the British didn't pursue that, because I know at the tail end of 1944, 1945, possibly, I'm not sure about the exact dates, but V2s were falling, these German rockets, ballistic missiles, effectively, going up into the upper atmosphere and then coming down very fast with conventional weapons. And I know that Churchill, from reading R.V. Jones's book all those years ago, was very worried that there was going to be actually a nuclear bomb on one of these V2 rockets. So why did the British give that up and let the Americans actually develop it?
Well, the first thing to say is that the first people to have the idea of basically how you can build a nuclear weapon were two refugees, Frisch and Piles, in Birmingham. And we know almost to the day, or certainly to the nearest 2 or 3 days, when they had that idea. And it was in Birmingham, in a particular room that you can visit now. It's got a blue plaque on it. And they hit on the idea of taking a particular isotope, a particular type of uranium, U-235, taking two lumps of it and firing them together. Now, they were the first people in the world to understand that you could do that. And they took that to top secret into Whitehall. And for the first 18 months or so, Britain was way ahead of the game, and we had many of our best scientists and industrialists looking in top secret at the viability of that bomb. And we, as I stress again, we were ahead of America at that time, no question.
So why did we not do it? And of course, the other question has got to be where can people go and see this room in Birmingham? And when was this? What point during the war was this actually happening?
They hit on this idea just a few weeks before Churchill became Prime Minister, roughly speaking, I would say about the 10th of March 1940, right? So you're really talking about an extremely tense time there, right? Just before Chamberlain resigned. Now, they had that idea, right? We need to be very clear here that although Frisch and Piles both understood that such a weapon could have enormous destructive capability, it was seen as a very remote possibility. And Britain and its empire had its back against the wall at that time. So they were very much dealing with present danger, so to speak. So the bomb was a very, how can I put it, it was very much at the back of the queue of the thousands of documents that were floating around Whitehall at the moment. Now, I have to say that it was actually very well handled by the civil service and the scientists. And really, I mean, it would be more newsworthy to say how terribly it was handled. It was all a big cock-up. But that really wasn't the case. It was very well handled, right? And people like James Chadwick, who discovered the neutron, very great nuclear scientist, first scientist to win a Nobel Prize for nuclear physics up in Liverpool. He was the person that pulled that together, and he concluded that a bomb really was viable. But we didn't have the money. We were being bombed. It was going to be an incredibly difficult thing for Britain to actually produce the fissile uranium to make that weapon. We, with the benefit of hindsight, we could never have done it, frankly, right? But my criticism in the book is that we had the know-how, so to speak, and that was, in my opinion, sold really quite cheap to the Americans. And there's a really amazing story here, Tony, that in October 1941, right? And you can go and read this memo in the Churchill archives in Cambridge. FDR, Franklin Roosevelt, actually wrote to Churchill to offer him a partnership in building the weapon, which is absolutely amazingly generous, right? Because America, of course, has hundreds of millions of dollars, but they weren't being bombed, right? And Churchill did not answer that offer for some 6 weeks. When Pearl Harbor happened in December that year, of course, America moved up from first gear into top gear, right? And then basically Britain was left behind. So that very broadly is how it came to pass.
Yeah, so Birmingham, I don't think most Brummies realise that the first thoughts and ideas of how to build a bomb were made in Birmingham. But whereabouts can people go and see this in Birmingham?
Well, they need to go to the physics laboratory near the Chamberlain Tower, and I tell you, there's an amazing story about that. Very few people know this, right? But in that same building was developed the cavity magnetron, which is where radar became something that you could take on board ship and on board aircraft, right? By a technology, I repeat, called the cavity magnetron. Now, Frisch and Pyles, the nuclear physicists, were not allowed to work on that because it was too secret. So it was in that building that device, which the great Henry Tizard, one of the great military science people of the 20th century, if not the greatest, he said that was the single most important development in the Second World War. And then along the corridor, Frisch and Pyles hit upon the idea of an atomic bomb. So both those things happened in that building. How about that?
Amazing. Where were Frisch and Pyles refugeed from?
Pyles from Germany and Frisch, he was actually working in Denmark. But they were people who were taken in somewhat reluctantly, I have to say, by the British authorities. They were both technically enemy aliens when they conceived that idea. And it's very funny looking at it now, as I say in Churchill's bomb, that after they conceived the idea, they weren't actually allowed to sit round the table to discuss the idea that they hatched for fear they might leak it.
So you call it Churchill's bomb, but in a way it's kind of slipped out of Churchill's hands into the hands of the US presidents, Truman and Roosevelt.
Yeah, I mean, if you take a literal-minded view, right, then, yeah, but it's a more boring title. It would be Churchill and the Bomb, right? But if you're being literal-minded, I accept that criticism. Right?
It was Churchill's baby, but it was actually put together, the first bomb, real bombs were put together over in the US. I mean, one of the critical ingredients is going to be uranium, not the easiest thing to come by, I would imagine, and especially to actually get enriched uranium, the U-235, to actually build the bomb. How did they do that?
Well, we couldn't have done it because it was, just one statistic, I think, will knock it out of the park here. In order to separate that rare form of uranium, you technically known as U-235, right, America virtually had, not virtually, they actually had to start a new industry. And the Manhattan Project became an industry was at the end of the Second World War was the fourth biggest industry in America. How about that? From nowhere, right? It was a gigantic project, right? Absolutely gigantic, and that's because America really wanted that weapon themselves.
I've heard figures of tens of thousands. It may even have been more people involved in the Manhattan Project, Graham. Any idea how many people were actually helping in the US make the bomb eventually?
I couldn't give you an exact figure, but it would be if you counted everybody in it, right? It would certainly be in the thousands. And many of those people did not know what they were actually doing. They didn't know the big picture. Right. So the people who really knew what were going on were General Groves, the people in Los Alamos, Oppenheimer and what have you. They really knew what was going on. But as I said, the people out in the people making those large samples of U-235, many of them just saw themselves as working in a giant factory, if you will.
I mean, how do you do a secret weapon project like the Manhattan Project with thousands, possibly even tens of thousands of people involved in it without the secret getting out?
Well, may I say, you've actually stated the thing perfectly, right? It did get out. Stalin knew exactly what was going on. I mean, you have to say, if it weren't so tragic, right, from the Allies' point of view, it was actually quite comic. Stalin knew of, for example, the first British feasibility plan into the bomb. He saw that before Churchill did, right? He actually had spies who were sending back to the Kremlin details of what was going on in the Manhattan Project all the time. And Roosevelt and Churchill both thought it was a completely sealed project. There was no leakage at all. That was complete nonsense. I mean, Stalin even knew about the delivery of the bomb. And of course, they told him that just before the end of the war, and he feigned great surprise, but all his officials knew about it.
Now, Churchill was obviously voted out in 1945 at the end of the Second World War, and he kind of disappeared, didn't he? And as I remember it, you may correct me here, he kind of popped back onto the political scene in the 1950s with this surprise announcement, hey, Britain's got an atomic bomb.
That's right. Well, he was, after he was kicked out, as he put it, being, you know, a person of inexhaustible energy, after getting over the shock, you know, he went off and wrote his memoirs and made himself a fortune and wrote the framework history of the Second World War. Right? He and on the sidelines, he was basically saying, "Where's the bomb? Where's the British bomb? Why? What, you know, where? What's happening?" And his deputy Attlee, whom Churchill had kept in the dark, had kept completely away from Parliament the story that Britain was actually building its own nuclear deterrent. So Churchill, when he finally came back to power, remarkably, in October 1951, just a couple of weeks after he got his premiership again, he was completely shocked to see that something like £100 million had been spent without parliamentary authority. Now, you're talking billions in today's money. Right. So, to the end of his days, Churchill never quite got over that he was that Parliament was sidestepped like that. He thought that was just not the way you should do things, and he was actually initially minded to stop going ahead with that project, which surprised me, surprised many experts who didn't know about that research, but emerged out of my research. He was turned round by Lindemann, his associate, and he then backed Attlee's project and became the first nuclear premier.
Interesting. So if the money didn't come through Parliament, where did it come from?
Do you know, I don't know the answer to that. It was, well, remember, there's a good precedent for this, and that's the first bomb itself, because FDR did exactly the same thing in America, right? That never got to the senators and Congress on Capitol Hill. He somehow squirreled away enough money to build the first nuclear weapons, which was a huge amount of money. Well, that's exactly what the British did. Right, during the 1950s, which was, of course, a time of great privation, right? You know, there was a lot, you know, all manner of hardships going on, but we were busy building the bomb.
Of course, there's an ethical side to this. A lot of people would have questioned, I would imagine, this in the late 40s and early 50s, saying, well, do we want to start another arms race?
That is right. But I have to say, to be completely fair about it, that at the time, the overwhelming opinion was that Britain needed to be at the top table with the United States, who at that time, this is the McCarthy era, Cold War, they actually passed a bill that meant they could not share their secrets, which many British scientists thought was absolutely deplorable, because we gave them the stuff about the British bomb in the first place, right? We actually helped them get started, and they were absolutely appalled by this. Piles, incidentally, who I remember I told you about him, and Fritsch, they were two people who thought the Americans played a very dirty game there. But anyway, Britain went ahead and built the bomb itself.
Just remind us how much it cost, because I think this will be a revelation for many people that the British atomic bomb, which emerged in the early 50s, was developed with money from outside somehow. They went round Parliament.
Well, it was £100 million by the time Churchill, just over £100 million by the time he became Prime Minister, which was October 51. So please don't quote me, but there will be the exact figure somewhere, but my rough guess would be something like £200 million. It would be billions of pounds.
In today's money, yeah. I mean, we can actually work. I think it's because I was doing another exercise for something else recently, looking at the money value between now and 1947, and that was 35 times. So yeah. I think you can work that out for yourself. Now, multiply it by 35, and you've got it in today's money.
And as I say, one can have views on the wisdom of this, you know, and it's not my job to try to convert people on this. All I would say, I think factually, if one can say that, but when the British got the bomb, of course there were people that said it was deplorable. The overwhelming feeling was, thank goodness we've got this weapon, right? I would stress again, there were people who didn't like it, right? But Attlee went ahead over the heads of his Labour colleagues and the Conservatives, that's Winston Churchill and co, basically were applauding him to the echo. And Churchill it went out of his way to congratulate Attlee on what he'd done afterwards.
Now, you painted a picture there after the war, after he'd been deselected by the British public, Churchill doing his memoirs, and it just brings to mind a quote, a very memorable quote from Churchill, where he says, "History shall be kind to me, I know, because I will write it." And I guess that's what he was doing at the time.
Exactly right, and he did that. And I might say, it's important to say this, that the deal that he brokered with FDR, which got Britain onto a small but non-trivial role into the Manhattan Project, part of that deal was that if the bomb were dropped, Churchill or the British Prime Minister had to sign, you know, the agreement to drop it. So the bombing of Hiroshima and Nagasaki, Churchill's signature was on that. He signed it in July 1945.
Now, there's another side to all this, because recently, like literally within the last few months, from US intelligence papers which have been revealed, there's something called Project Unthinkable or Operation Unthinkable. Apparently, General Patton, the US general who was commanding the sort of the south of the Western Front against the Nazis towards the end of the war, wasn't alone when he wanted to continue the war and attack Moscow, because apparently, according to these US documents, Winston Churchill was also interested in using nuclear weapons against the Russians at the end of the war. Is this something you've come across in your research?
Yes, and I must say some Churchill experts did not believe me. I give two references in the book, and I found another one later, right? So I consider that, and I think most people, they accepted, actually, to be fair, they did back down. The correct way to put it is that Churchill, in private, urged a first strike on Moscow. That is correct, right? He did not do it in public, but he did in private.
What was the purpose of that? Why was he thinking like that? Surely you didn't want to start World War III just as soon as World War II had finished.
That you could ask that question. His reasoning at the time was that that Russia was so dangerous that the only way to stop it taking over Eastern Europe, right, was to do something that would be a dramatic gestures, not the wrong word, but take a dramatic action. So there we are. Churchill's not here to defend himself. But he, as I said, we have clear evidence, right, that three times, as I say, to my certain knowledge, people heard him say, right, that we should attack Moscow straight up.
Amazing. And a bit cheeky of Churchill, really, since, I mean, for example, Poland, it was agreed with Stalin, would be taken over, and other Eastern European countries, by the Soviet Union at Yalta. So he'd sat there, in a way, and shook hands with Stalin and said, you know, yes, we're going to do a deal here, while quietly he's thinking behind his breath, maybe we're going to nuke these guys. Anyway, quite an interesting angle on it all. But I read a book recently called Bomber Beaching by Richard Cotterill, and he's a former editor of the British Aircraft Corporation magazine for a couple of decades. Was also a Conservative member of the European Parliament for the Conservative Party a few years ago. And he said that Richard Beeching, who was better known really for closing down Britain's railways in the 1960s, also had a role in the atomic bomb project. I wonder if you came across the Beeching figure in the 40s or 50s, Graham.
I haven't, I'm afraid. That's news to me. I think I would have known about it, but I'm afraid I can't answer that. At least I can, but I haven't come across that name.
Well, apparently there was an organisation called Tube Alloys, which was set up as a cover organisation to be involved in building the bomb. And
That's definitely correct.
And that a lot of the research went on a place called Fort Halstead underneath the North Downs near Seven Oaks in Kent.
Right. Yeah, I've passed that many a time, yeah.
Have you also traced any of the activities back to Fort Halstead, which I understand now I think has just been privatised or sold off?
Yeah, that was part, a very important part, of the British bomb project, because that was where they were doing a lot of testing, and where this huge project that was led by William Penny, Christopher Hinton, the engineer, and John Cockcroft, a famous Cambridge scientist, those were the three so-called atomic knights who led the British project. I must say, in their own terms, with very considerable distinction, because it is true that the Americans did it first, but the British did it with really only scraps of information that they could get out of, or from memory, of the Manhattan Project, and with far less money. And yet they did it. They actually built an independent weapon. And a lot of that work was done, as you say, at Fort Housden.
The other side, of course, of this is that you've got, during the war, you've got, at the very least, we know, the British, the Americans and the Germans all working on trying to get a race to build the first atomic bomb, which could, of course, be a war winner. They knew that, especially if the Germans had nuked London. This would have been, you know, absolutely devastating in the Second World War. And the Nazis obviously were stockpiling uranium, doing a similar thing to the British and the Americans were. I wonder, have you discovered what happened to the Nazis' U-235? And it may even have been that they got some plutonium too.
It's certainly true that they had some uranium. I don't know. They certainly didn't have anything like enough to build a nuclear weapon. I mean, there is some scholarly material on this, but we're always interested in more. Because Hitler was really appallingly inept at handling science. This is where Churchill was far superior. He, for all his infuriating idiosyncrasies, you know, he knew the value of science.
But hang on, Graham, because at the time the Nazis were being defeated, but they were still developing these vengeance weapons, the V1, the doodle bug, the flying bomb, which was effectively the world's first smart bomb, and then also the V2, which was a ballistic missile. So they were actually very good at technology.
Oh, they were extremely good at technology, but it was also very inefficient. I mean, I don't know of any weapons project less efficient than the V1 and V2 bombers, right? If you look at the number of people who were killed or maimed by those things, it was an incredibly inefficient weapon to build. In fact, Lindemann, who was not at all popular as an advisor, he actually didn't believe they were doing it because his calculations were broadly correct, that it would be a stupid thing to do, right? And the Nazis invested a huge amount of money in this project because they didn't think through carefully enough the wisdom of developing that technology.
Now, I'm going to take issue with you there, because I think that the Nazis sat down and they thought, what we want is to really to hit British morale, and that's what it was aimed at, those weapons.
Oh, yeah, I know. Again, it's a fair point, but yeah, you'll know that scholars are very divided on this, that the ability to actually break a country through bombing and morale is very, very debatable. You know, it's certainly, in fact, funnily enough, actually, my late mother was under those V1s, and I know it affected morale, right? I mean, just from anecdotal stuff as well as stuff I've read, but it wasn't enough to actually bring the country to its knees, right? That's the key thing.
Well, there's another side to it, of course, and the Spitfire pilots were quite dab hands, weren't they, flying alongside the V1s and then using the wings to flip them over, and then they get a big cheer from the public as they manage to do that.
V1 and V2, clever but disastrous as an investment.
I think the Americans possibly would disagree with you after Wernher von Braun made it over to the United States and helped them to build their first ballistic missiles, and also, of course, helped the Americans get to the moon.
That's not what I'm saying. I'm saying disastrous as an investment in war technology.
What about Desmond Morton? I wonder, because he's one of these characters that was spent quite a lot of time with Churchill as his private personal assistant. I wonder if you came across his involvement with the bomb project as part of your research.
Well, yeah, I did, but he was one of the people that would he was kept miles away, figuratively speaking, from the bomb, because Churchill saw it as extremely secret. Where he did know about Churchill and the bomb was he knew that Churchill was completely obsessed with the threat of the hydrogen bomb after he read about it in 1954. This became a total obsession of Churchill's. I've actually met people who knew Churchill at that time, and that's the only thing he was interested in as Prime Minister, right? In his opinion, the Cold War made a nuclear accident, so to speak. In other words, the you know, the use of that bomb in anger, right, possibly by accident, would be a terrible disaster. And he resolved to try to bring the superpowers together at a table, of course, broken by him. He wasn't short of ego. And eventually that project failed. But in my opinion, and I must say it's not unique to me. This, he can be regarded as the pioneer of détente in trying to bring America and Russia together to, if you like, see reason from the escalating tensions of the Cold War.
So what you're saying is Morton really, even though he was Churchill's personal assistant, this was all way above Morton's head, because Morton is quite notorious as somebody who seemed to be involved in almost all of the intrigue that Churchill was too.
Yeah, I would be very surprised if he knew any of the minutiae, but I know that he knew of Churchill's relative indifference to nuclear weapons at the first part of his second premiership, and at the end he would think about nothing else. He was completely obsessed with nuclear weapons. That's what his last great speech in Parliament was all about, was thermonuclear warfare.
Graham, tell us a little bit about yourself and your qualifications or otherwise for putting this book together.
Well, I used to be a physicist. Particularly in theoretical physics, the sort of stuff that Einstein and others did. Then I got interested in history and biography, and that's how I got in from the back door, so to speak, into this subject, which is about Churchill, his scientists, and nuclear weapons. So it was quite an experience for me. And as I said, even now I could still remember the shock of reading articles that Churchill had written in the 1930s about the coming, what we will call nuclear weapons, right? I couldn't believe this. I thought, he can't have written this, but he did. So that was, to me, the most exciting thing I uncovered in this project.
Tell us a bit about your, what were you doing in physics? And, I mean, if you say you were doing the sort of Einstein stuff, what would you like to share with listeners about some of the things you've started to understand about the universe, about that, you know, unquantifiable things? What would you like to share with us about some of the things you've come across you don't think that most people know about?
Well, I have to say, I wouldn't want to compare myself for one nanosecond with Einstein. I was very interested in the what happens when those subnuclear particles get together and the forces between them. This basically helps us understand the very most basic laws of nature. And my next book is about that topic, which has always fascinated me since I was a graduate student, about how we can get to the most basic understanding of the natural world through mathematics in particular, not just through experiments, that's incredibly important, but also through mathematics.
Well, there are some people who say that when the first atomic bomb was exploded, Graham, nobody really knew what was happening. It could have vaporized the universe in the chain reaction that went right across the world. And I wonder if maybe, you know, you'd like to just tell us, I mean, when they did test it, do you think that they really knew what was going to happen?
Yes. Yes, definitely. And what's more, the predictions were almost bang on. I mean, when I say almost, I'm being generous, right? They did all their homework, they did the thing, and it worked, right? It worked. And it just shows that I would actually say that's one of the best examples of how fundamental physics, although it's incredibly remote from experience, millions of times more than we can see, we understand what's going on well enough to make a prediction like that. And the first nuclear weapon exploded exactly as the theoretician said it would.
Amazing. About particle physics? What is it that humanity can gain from this, or is it just a little bit of fun? And is it, you know, the idea is that we ought to try and find this out because we can?
Well, that last bit is the way I would put it. I think it's important. I think it's absolutely vital. I think what makes us a special species is not just our iPhones and our TVs and our nonstick saucepans. All right, that's fun. I've got them too. It's great that we have science developing that. But to me, what is most precious is our understanding of the universe that we're in. And the miracle is that we have this thing called science, backed up by mathematics, that really does enable us to understand these basic laws about the way the universe is put together and how we now have a picture of the universe right from the Big Bang at the very beginning of the universe, right up to the present and beyond. We have an amazingly detailed understanding of the universe. Mind you, there's still a lot to do. But to me, this is I would rate this as one of the great projects of humanity. There are others, music, human welfare, art, sure, but the understanding of the fundamental laws of the universe, I think, is a fantastic achievement for humanity.
Some would say, well, we can put a man on the moon, but we've still got people sleeping homeless in shop doorways here in Bristol.
Yeah, no, that's true. That will always be the case. And I wish passionately that were not the case. But still, I think for the tiny amount of money that it costs, and it is tiny, I mean, the total amount of money we spend in this country on understanding the fundamental laws of the universe would be roughly 2 cappuccinos a year for every taxpayer. I think that's well worth it.
And where do you think is Britain standing nowadays in things like theoretical physics, in the area of really cutting-edge technology?
Britain does pay punch well above its weight in the world of science and technology. There's no doubt about that. But I hope very much that it will continue. Still, the work that science is a global activity. The United States tends to be the leader. They had that fantastic discovery of gravitational waves a month or two ago. But Britain still has got great scientists. Stephen Hawking, of course, is the most famous. He's not necessarily the greatest, but he's the most famous. And he's a poster boy, so to speak, for, I think, a great tradition of British science.
Okay, Graham Farmelow, author of Churchill's Bomb, thanks very much for joining us on Dialect.
Thank you, Tony. It's a great pleasure.
You're listening to dialectradio.co.uk. UK.
And I'm joined now from Mid Wales by Lawrence Morton. Hi, Lawrence, and welcome to Dialect.
Hi, Tony. Thanks for calling me.
You are a photographer, I understand. Tell us a little bit about the work you've done.
Okay, well, I've been in photography all my life. Ever since a kid, I've loved photography. But I did start off in civil engineering, which is a bit of a mistake. And then in my 20s, I went back to art college. And it was the best thing I ever did in my life. And worked in photography all my life, having a lot of fun. Yes, I've been through all types of photography in my life, and in the last 4 years, because of the sort of digital changeover and the internet, really, I started in press photography, which I really enjoy, and that's what I'm still doing.
Sounds to me as if you're going in the opposite direction to most people, because most press photographers I know say it's been more and more difficult to get work, almost impossible.
Yeah, it's very true, and the money is really not good at all, but it's new for me, and probably if I'd been in it 30 years all my life, I'd probably give it up, but I enjoy it. I enjoy the challenge, even if I can just pay expenses.
What about some of the shoots you've done in the past? Have you ever come across any interesting or famous people?
Oh, my gosh. I came across more famous people in my earlier days when I started off as a fashion photographer, and I was assistant to the late Norman Parkinson, MBE, and we photographed royalty and princesses and goodness knows who. But in press photography, I obviously, if David Cameron's here, at the Royal Welsh Show, I'll photograph him or Osborne, various people like that.
So if you photographed royalty, I mean, how do they behave when you... Because as a photographer, you've got to sort of order people around, haven't you? You've got to tell them, right, move over that way. How do they react to that?
Well, actually, I wasn't taking the pictures. Norman Parkinson, I was assisting him. And when he was... I remember with the Queen, the Queen Mum, and Princess Margaret at Windsor. But I remember him saying... okay, girls, show us your teeth, you know. And I think the Queen quipped, yes, we've paid enough for them, let's show them, which is quite funny. So it was just as an assistant, and it was wonderful with Norman Parkinson. I was assistant, I had no responsibility. We travelled the world. All I had to do was load the film in the camera and enjoy myself. He had the responsibility.
But, we've got you on here really to talk about the sort of post 9/11 world and the 9/11 attacks. How did you go from being someone who was really into photography as a profession to then start to question what we were seeing and hearing about the 9/11 attacks?
Well, this was, I have to thank my very good friend, Craig Jenkins, who lives the most idyllic life in the Alps. He's a top ski man and a paraglider pilot. He makes his living from his paragliding sport. And one day I just opened my email inbox and I had an email from him. And he started a website and that he'd been researching 9/11. And I just clicked a few links that he'd sent me. And my jaw just dropped, Tony. It was, I couldn't believe what I was seeing. So,
as a photographer, what was it that particularly piqued your interest then?
Just lifestyle. I've always been interested in life. But throughout my life, I've had suspicions. You know, things didn't tie up. The ongoing Middle East war. But I think what it was going back to that day. It's like Diana's assassination or Kennedy's assassination. There are days that stick in our brains. We know exactly where we were and what day of the week it was. And I remember I was in Greece on a photo assignment, and I heard people talking about these planes being hijacked. What? So I rushed back to the bar, grabbed a coffee, and I just sat, you know, like we all did, in front of these screens. But there were these three thoughts that went through my brain immediately. The first one, because I'd been in civil engineering before and I had a good idea of it, I thought buildings just do not fall like this. Surely not. I know they don't fall like this. If they do, I'm never going to go in a skyscraper again. So that was my first thought, my first immediate one. The second was, how in the world did hijackers commandeer four commercial airlines and fly them around at random in the most protected airspace in the whole world? And the final one, third thought, was how did they know who it was so quickly? I mean, murders take decades to solve. How did they know it was Osama bin Laden? And that was maybe my photographic eye just looking at it, and I was there on a photo job, and on the plane back, we couldn't take the cameras in the cabin. They had to get in hold, and that was that.
So it's interesting that you were asking these questions right on the day itself, straight away, Lawrence. How long did it take you to really ask serious questions about these 9/11 attacks, though? The penny
dropped.
Well,
Tony, it was I did pick up a video, Fahrenheit 9/11, Michael Moore's film, from the library, and I kind of that did trigger a few things. And then I remember just seeing the odds, just coming across the internet without searching, photo of the Pentagon in the hole and the plane not fitting, but I didn't take it much further. And then another friend of mine, a paraglider friend, who was quite a way ahead of me in certain things, philosophical things, he gave me a David Icke book. Now, that was probably 2006, 7, somewhere around then. And I remember kind of reading his The Reptile Thing and thinking, well, I don't know where he's at on that one. I'm sure there's a reason. But I got onto the Princess Diana chapter, and I was totally fascinated. So I started investigating that. And then, of course, when Craig's, my friend in the Alps, Craig's email came through, that was the big kind of light bulb moment. You know, I think, right, this whole lot needs investigating. And I was quite fascinated with it, and I just dug deeper and deeper.
What was it that was in the evidence that you saw from your friend that convinced you? Was it looking at photographs, written analysis, testimony, interviews? What?
Oh, it was the early links, really. But one thing about Craig is, he's always been ahead of the game, and he's very honest, trustworthy. He's not the sort of person that would come up with something that was nonsense. He had researched it. He said in his email he'd researched it for 3 years and then gone back and researched it for another few years. So I know he'd done his homework, and I trusted him. And he sent me the Kennedy speech and Architects and Engineers website. it was obvious it was an inside job. I suppose possibly my instincts all my life that things haven't been right. This was just a final sort of, you know, the proof, really.
And you have to, I suppose, you know, reanalyze your life, where you're heading, who you trust, all this sort of thing. Did you have to do that?
Oh, my gosh. Well, when I had this email, I said, oh, well, this is just great. You know, this is not a problem. We've got the internet now and we've got emails. I'll just email my friends. I'll tell my friends. And but I was gobsmacked by their reaction. It was like I was just a total loony, you know. Their face would drop and they'd change the subject and they'd look at me askance. And I lost quite a few friends like this. So I had to change tactics. I was a little bit, started off a little bit in your face sort of thing. So I realized you have to back off and not thrust this down people's throats.
So, I mean, is there any way, do you think, for ordinary people here in the UK or anyone else listening in the West or elsewhere to fight and beat the New World Order? Because it does seem as if it's quite a lot of power. But it may be that much of their power is just through fear.
Yeah, there is only way. And David Icke had that answer when people asked him. He said, we outnumber this scum mafia banksters. We outnumber them billions to one. But it's no good if we don't realize it. We have to get off our asses and all those people out there. Okay, you're doing your jobs and you're a little bit tired, but just put in a little time and open up your brain. Stop believing in this fairyland, this nonsense that we're being given by this BBC Brainwashing Corporation and the rest of them, and get on the internet while you've got it and learn what's going on. The only way we can fight it is to educate ourselves. If we remain ignorant and believe that our governments are doing us a favor and looking after us, and these banksters don't have control. They have control over all the central banks. They have control over the IMF. They have control over every penny we earn. If we don't start learning about it, we are totally finished as a planet. I mean, it could be, will it be a nuclear war? Will it be a nuclear one? Or will it be a financial war when we're all given this new currency, which will be just, what do they call it, special drawing rights, I believe the IMF are going to bring in as soon as they crash the dollar and all the currency. Then we'll just have a chip in our hands with a digital money, and then we'll be just totally doomed.
I think it's Catherine Albrecht in the US that's done a website called chipmenot.com, which is really, I mean,
oh,
I go
chip me not.
Yeah, chipmenot.com, which is quite a positive site. It's basically saying, look, you know, whatever they do to you, don't take a microchip. And funnily enough, I was in the countryside recently and there was a sign up about a lost dog saying, can't find our dog, haven't seen it for a week or 2 weeks or something. Please phone this number. Oh, and by the way, it's got a chip. So if you think that your microchipped dog is going to be help you to find it, then think again. Anyway, look, Lawrence, it's been fascinating chatting with you. I wonder if you'd just like to leave us by saying how people can follow some of your work online.
Well, I'm on Twitter at Lawrence Morton. That's LAURENCEMORTON. And on Facebook, I think I'm the other way around, Morton Lawrence. But I'm mostly on Twitter, really. And on Twitter, Twitter is wonderful. They've got, I think, the paper.live. They do this little newspaper. It's free to anybody on Twitter. And mine's called the Lawrence Morton Daily. And I pin to the top of my page on Twitter the daily paper. It's a collation of followers, links. So anybody wants to go to Twitter, Lawrence Morton, at Lawrence Morton, and the Lawrence Morton Daily. Lawrence Morton Daily will come up in Google as well.
What about some of your press photographs? Things like, it sounded lovely, your pictures of the snowy Welsh mountains.
Oh, yeah. Well, my professional website for my photography is www.photolawrence. Now, that's spelt with an F. F-O-T-O-L-A-W-R-E-N-C-E, photolawrence.com. Nice and simple.
Lawrence Morton from Mid Wales. Thanks very much for joining us on Dialect.
Tony, thank you very much for having me.
Well, that's all for this week. Dialect is Bristol's first weekly MP3 podcast, broadcast on community radio stations in Bristol, Swindon, Preston and St Albans from mid-March 2016, back on BCFM here in Bristol from 12 noon on Tuesdays. If you're online, you can subscribe to our emails or download the podcast from dialectradio.co.uk. Thanks to this week's guests, Graham Farmelow, author of Churchill's Bomb, and also photographer from Mid Wales, Lawrence Morton. Also to studio engineer, Dave Bazenko. Dialect's a Bristol Broadband Co-op production, and anyone can contribute. Contact us through PRSC, who are just off Jamaica Street. They're on 0117 909 6897 and on the web at prsc.org.uk. So, that was Dialect. And I'm Tony Gosling, wishing you a very good week. Thanks for listening. Till the same time next week, goodbye for now. We'll be right back.
Why pam 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 kawere.